Come on, everybody. We are in the moment of passion, our throes of passion, the beast with two backs, if you will.
Dio disagrees with this.
Shut the fuck up. Move on.
Okay.
Sorry. Better not be Toto.
What?
Fuck that. I'm Augustus.
Get your fucking... Yeah, like, I don't even watch Star Trek, and I know that the chronology...
It was still
the other way
Trek
around.
Land, but at the end of the day, you have to get past that cynicism.
So, shut the fuck up. What do you want?
I'm emotionally spent. I'm done for the night. Was that Rob again?
Oh, they're all Rob, yes. That was Rob, guys.
Rob.
Welcome back to The Life of Augustus, episode 78. And we are going to pick up where we left off in 76 before our little detour to talk about the similarities between Trump and Caesar.
That was fun.
With 12 BCE is where we're picking up here, which was the year when Drusus, one of Augustus's adult stepsons, who's now in control of Gaul, as we mentioned last time, in 12 BCE he completed a census in the Three Gauls, as it was known, the three different provinces of Gaul.
Could you picture being in your 20s and being responsible for that massive chunk of land and have your stepfather / emperor looking over your shoulder? That would be a little nerve-wracking.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing about Drusus, as we mentioned a few episodes ago, he was very, very popular, very dashing, very handsome, brave, pretty good general, and just loved by his soldiers and by the people generally. He had some sort of magical quality about him, Drusus. He was a man of the people, a bit like sort of, I don't know, the dash of a young Marcus Antonius, but he wasn't a complete dick like Mark Antony was either. So,
right.
Yeah.
And he was the real deal. He was well-loved. He was a good general. He was a good statesman. He was a good governor, if that's the proper term. And, yeah, so he ran things well, and his father-in-law gave him a big job, not only to run the Three Gauls, but to do the census, and because there's a very specific reason why they need this rather detailed information for future operations.
And why is that, Ray? Why would you run a census in the Three Gauls?
Well, I guess, you just really want to get a sense of what's out there, how many people, who owns what. I mean, what kind of money are we talking about here? What kind of food? I mean, what exactly are we in charge of? Because you and I both know that they're going to skim some of that off of the top because they're going to need it when they start going to crossing the Rhine to wage war, because you need food, you need money, you need supplies, and you're going to take it from Gaul. Why take it from Rome when you can take it from one of your provinces?
I like that. You said you want to do it to get a sense of what's going on. You do a census to get a sense.
Maybe that's where the word comes from. I don't know. Rob, you better not fucking touch that.
Well, no, it's kind of similar. So the word sense, to get a sense of something, comes from the Latin sensus with an S, meaning the faculty of feeling, thought, or meaning, from sentire, meaning feel. But sensus with a C comes from sensere, meaning to assess. So... not really got a lot in common, apart from the fact that they sounded like, get a sense of what's going on with the census. That was the tagline for their advertising campaign. The new Roman census. Let's get a sense. Us.
Participate in the census so we can get a sense of you.
Yeah. How about you give us a sense of how much money you have? Yeah, so they... Yeah, so they had to figure out how much tax each person had to pay. Now, Augustus had personally supervised the first census in Gaul back in 27 BCE, listeners may recall.
Wow.
But things had changed a lot since then, and obviously...
Yeah, they had computers now.
Yeah. They had iPhones and they had apps, and they go, look, it's so easy. You just stick your numbers in an app.
Just stick it right there.
It'll scan your eyeball and send it back to the NSA. The new census, obviously we talked a few episodes ago about Licinius, who was a Gaul and one of the governors and was ripping people off and exploiting the fact that they didn't understand the new calendar. He was going, oh, no, the end.
Two more months.
December, that means 10. There must be two more months left, right? You know, calendar's got 12 months in it, right? No, you got to keep paying the tax. He was pocketing it. So maybe this was intended to right the wrongs of Licinius. Now, readers of the Bible, of which I am one, as you know, will be aware that in the Bible there is this story about how Augustus held a single census across the entire empire around about the time that Jesus was born, and that's the excuse for why Joseph and Mary had to go to Bethlehem. Now, do you know where in the Bible that appears, Ray?
Good God, no.
Okay.
No pun intended.
So what's the earliest books in the Bible? What's the earliest writings in the Bible?
All I learned at Bible school, and don't judge me, was Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. I don't know anything else except for those names in that particular order. That is all I know.
Which writer wrote the majority of the words of the New Testament?
The first one? No, that's a guess. I have no idea. Matthew? I'm putting $2 on Matthew.
It's actually Paul. The letters of Paul, or the epistles as they're referred to, is actually half of the New Testament comes from the epistles of Paul. And Paul is the earliest writer of all of the materials that we have in the New Testament. And as far as we know, the earliest writer of anything that survived in Christianity. And Paul started writing around about late 50s. His letters span sort of late 50s to about 60, and then they disappear and people assume he was killed around about then. Paul, in his writings, mentions nothing about Jesus's birth or life at all, pretty much.
Wow.
Apart from he was born of a woman and was crucified, that's all Paul has to say on Jesus's life. Doesn't mention his ministry, any of the things that Jesus said when he was walking around, anything.
Dude, why in the hell, no pun intended, why in the hell did he write about him?
Well, Paul's letters were mostly being written to churches around the distant parts of the Roman Empire, mostly in Turkey, Asia Minor, places like that, with the exception of Romans, to writing to churches about disputes they were having. See, one of the things that people don't often understand about early Christianity is there was a lot of disputes going on in, like, between when Jesus supposedly died, 30-33 CE, right through to 400 CE, 400 AD. There was a lot of argument, disputation about, was Jesus divine or just a human? Was he the Messiah or just a naughty boy? What did he preach? Was it for Jews or was it open to Gentiles? If you're a Gentile, did you need to get circumcised? These arguments and disputes went on right from the very beginning. And what Paul's epistles are really about is disputes were arising in some of these churches, some of which he had founded, others of which he hadn't founded. In fact, Romans, the book of Romans to the church in Rome, he hadn't even been to Rome at that juncture. He was writing a letter to introduce himself. Hi, my name is Paul. You may have heard of me. You may have seen my earlier work. It's not really a biography of Jesus. He barely mentions him at all, just to say, hey, Jesus, fucking wasn't he great? Stop having sex with everyone else's wives. Dirty, dirty people. In fact, don't have sex at all if you can avoid it. Because Jesus is going to be back next week. And you need to be getting ready.
Judge your asses.
Yeah, you need to be packing the shit that you want to take with you to the afterlife, because the second coming is coming any second. Boom, I just made that up. I lied. My marketing people have been working on that for a long time. And
$50,000.
Cost us an absolute fortune. But they come highly recommended. Stalin used them to name Stalingrad, and he was pretty happy with that.
Yeah, it's a good name.
Anyway, where was I? All right, so Paul, first writer, doesn't mention anything about Jesus' birth. The first of the Gospels, the biographies of Jesus, is Mark. It's the earliest and the shortest, probably written around about 70 CE. Mark mentions nothing about Jesus' birth. The next is Matthew. He doesn't mention, he mentions a little bit about the birth. It's probably written about 80 CE. He mentions a little bit about the birth, but not much. Luke, probably written about 90 CE, is the first writings that we have that mentions this story about the census. In fact, it's the only story in the book of the Bible that mentions the census. And in fact, it's the only writing anywhere in recorded history that mentions that Augustus held a single census across the entire empire. There's no other evidence that Augustus held a single census across the empire around about the time that Jesus was born, or any other time for that matter.
Right. So is it your contention that the other sources were just lost, or maybe this person misunderstood, or that there was no census held by the Romans?
Well,
I just want to make sure I understand.
Either could be true. Perhaps it did happen and it just didn't, you know, it's not mentioned in any of the surviving sources. However, when you look at all of the other facts about Luke and the other Gospels in terms of their historical foundation, yeah, they're not good sources of history by any stretch of the imagination, and shouldn't be considered as history. They're the equivalent of Plutarch's biography on Romulus. They're just, hey, these stories have been told, and these are the stories that we like to talk about. I mean, it's basically it's not a Superman comic, but it's a novel about, you know, the life of Luke Skywalker. And his rise to power.
His adventures.
Right. Yeah. For a Jedi community, there was this community of Jedi, and they've been telling stories about Luke Skywalker if Jesus did exist and died around 30, Luke's writing in 90. So that's 60 years in Rome, in the Roman Empire. That's when people usually got married at like anywhere between 15 and 20, and started having kids immediately. 60 years is 2 to 3 generations later.
Yeah.
So stories have been passed down. If Jesus did in fact live, if not, then they were just stories that were made up. Just gossip that had spread, mythology that had been built up. And, you know, whoever wrote the Gospel of Luke wasn't anyone called Luke, most probably. Officially named the Gospel according to Luke. In the beginning of the Gospel according to Luke, if I remember correctly, he says, look, lots of people have been telling stories about Jesus, but most of them are bullshit. I'm going to write down the real stories here.
But
he doesn't mention who his sources are. He says, I went and talked to a lot of people. They told me the real shit. The rest of them are fake news. This is the real truth. Yeah, but he doesn't explain why. So how'd I get onto that? Anyway, it's possible it happened, but probably not. It's possible that it happened just in some part of Palestine or a different part of Asia Minor where the author was living, and stories have been passed down that there was a census and he just decided it was empire-wide. Maybe he just made it up for dramatic effect, of a way of explaining why Jesus was born in Bethlehem instead of Galilee Nazareth, because there was, an Old Testament verse that predicted that a future leader would come from Bethlehem, so they needed to kind of shoehorn the Jesus story into Bethlehem and say, oh, yeah, that's right, we'd forgotten that. Yeah, his mum and dad had to go to Bethlehem because there was some. And, like, the story is you had to return to the place you were born. Can you imagine if everybody in the Roman Empire had to return to the place where they were born for the census? What kind of a fucking nightmare that would have been. Like yeah, people I mean, had
one
settled.
Gigantic market. Yeah.
And people had settled all over and they'd moved for either they'd military veterans have been placed in different parts of, you know, different settlements, or people have moved for commercial reasons or whatever. And Augustus goes, "Nah, everyone, you need to go back to the place you were born." Be like millions of people leaving their jobs, their farms, their homes, traveling. Just to go, "Oh, I'm here now. You counted me, right? All right, now I'm going to go. Now I'm going to spend 3 months going back to where I'm from." Like, fuck off.
No, you walk up and you go here, and then you turn around and go back. Yeah.
I tend to think that if that had happened, it would have survived in a fucking historical source, because it would have been the biggest fucking clusterfuck of all time.
The economy would have been ruined.
Everything, well, yeah, and people would have been bitching about it for the rest of their lives. That dumb cunt Augustus.
Did I tell you the time I had to walk 3 months, just stay here, and then I went back?
Anyway, now you can imagine, Ray, that people don't particularly like paying tax, full stop, let alone paying tax to an occupying power.
Right, you kick my ass, and then you make me pay. That's not very nice.
Yeah. Now, Livy and Dio, in their histories, hint that there were some troubles in Gaul over this whole taxation thing, but they don't really provide any details, and it's likely that the problems weren't on a small scale, and whatever they were, Drusus probably just shut it down. But there were also benefits from being part of the census as well. Do you want to talk about the benefits?
Well, at least that way, if Rome conducts a census to get a sense, at least what you own is on the official record. So that way, if there's any kind of argument later on, or if Licinius comes back and tries to steal your shit for the last 2 months, you can show that you properly owned it. So again, it might not be the best thing in the world, but if there's an official record or receipt or whatever, at least you have that protecting you, because as we know, Romans took that kind of ownership of property and the cataloging of it very seriously.
And I think there are other trade-offs as well. I mean, we know that the Gauls, before the Romans came in, I mean, we tend to think of, the poor Gauls, they were just living in peace and harmony and planting daisies. Right. And, they just said, they had these little thatched cottages with cows they were milking and you know, they were just, it was like free love and right. The drinking beer all day, lying in hammocks, chilling. Nasty Julius Caesar came in and killed them all. Now, we know that's not true. We know that, as with the Native Americans before the European invasion, the indigenous Australians before the Europeans invaded, same thing with the Gauls and the Germanic tribes as well. There was a lot of tribe-on-tribe action going on throughout history. A lot of internecine warfare between tribes vying for supremacy, trying to take their lands, trying to take their wealth, trying to take their women. And one of the things that happened, now I'm not saying that imperialism or occupation is morally justified because of that, but it's a bit like the benefits of Augustus after the civil wars in Rome. Yes, he was effectively the emperor, and people lost a lot of theoretical political power when it was centralized in his hands. But the flip side is the benefits were no more civil wars. Right. The same thing, I think, with you have to understand when you look at places like Gaul. The benefit of having an occupying power is an end of civil war. All of these tribes can't fight each other anymore. You got your land, you got your area, stick to it, right. Prosper. So there is a certain amount of safety, security, economic stability. You're giving up some money in terms of tax, but that's paying for the protection of the Roman military to prevent future civil wars.
Right. You've got someone to report to. If someone steals something or does something, you've got a stronger authority that you can go to.
Imperialism and occupation, and in fact, I tell you, Hurari's book *Sapiens* explains this quite well. Mm-hmm. There are positives as well as negatives with imperialism. It always brings benefits as well as negatives, and I think that would have been the case in situations like this in the ancient world as well.
Yeah, there's always a good and a bad. And like you said, the men had based, part of the culture was, you know, to take things from your neighbor and to glory in fighting in battle. But of course, for the women and children who get killed or abducted or have their homes destroyed, obviously it's not good for them. So Rome comes in, they put a blanket on all that stuff, and they need stability because they know that with stability will come greater economic activity, which means there's more to tax and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's not what you want, but some part of your population is going to enjoy the lack of being raided by your neighbors once or twice a year.
They bled us white, bastards. They take everything we had. And not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labor the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct.
What?
The aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine. Huh? Education.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, yeah, that's something we'd really miss, Reg, if the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, a fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
History lessons from the Pythons.
They should just play that in the history class and the teacher can just sit down in his chair and just eat some popcorn.
I think the problem, though, is everyone watches that and we laugh about it, but that's actually true about imperialism from all eras. And I still think that imperialism is probably on net balance a bad thing, but it does bring its positives. And I'm sure there were people in Gaul in 9 BCE going, well, you know, the Romans, yeah, yes, okay, they've taken our shit and raped our women, but, you know, the roads, the wine. Now,
trade-off.
Drusus was getting ready during this period, apart from doing the census, to cross the Rhine. Yeah. He was going to go and teach those fucking Germans a lesson.
Problem, slight problem with that is that, you know, and we can get into this or not get into it or get into it later. Were they really Germans? What was the difference between them and the Gauls? And there's been a lot of cultural exchanges for the last, how many knows, decades or whatever. But yeah, it's convenient just to say, look, those bastards are Germans and I'm going to cross this big ass river and teach them a lesson so they'll respect Rome. Makes for good propaganda.
So he set up a series of large military bases near the Rhine. We don't know exact numbers, but he probably had something in the region. We think of 8 legions, plus obviously substantial numbers of auxiliary troops and some war galleys and transport ships. There's actually archaeological evidence of one base near modern-day Nijmegen, in Holland on the river Waal. I hope I've pronounced those things incorrectly because I wouldn't want to break my track record.
If it helps, that's 30, that city that I can't say, or that port city is 30 miles or 48 kilometers due east of Rotterdam, just to give you an idea of how far north these Romans are going to bitch slap the Germans.
Now, this archaeological site is about 42 hectares in size, which they say probably housed 2 legions. And interestingly, I thought, unlike my sort of vision in my head of a Roman military camp, which is very, very uniform, very ordered, nice rectangle with lots of evenly spaced tents for the troops to sleep in and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Very, very ordered. Apparently, at this point in time, it wasn't necessarily always that way. In fact, they would often build bases to take advantage of good natural positions. So they were sometimes built on high ground and they'd have to follow the flow of the land. So there could be 6, 7, or 8 sides to a base. And a lot of the regulations for building military bases, Augustus came up with later. And then they remained in place for at least a century without any significant changes.
So that's another thing that Rome has done for people. They have helped them develop standard military bases and camps for future generations. And again, we take all this for granted, but this is just one more of the many things that Augustus is doing because he is the leader of this empire. For decades, he has the time to focus on all these little details. And so by the time he is gone, yes, there will be a folder in place. There will be a notebook where you can look up the proper way to build a Roman camp because he is having people work on this as they're going to attack the Germans or whoever they're attacking at the time. So he is developing the playbook from scratch. And again, it's just one of the many benefits that you get from having a person be in power for a very long time. They can bring uniformity to so many different aspects of Roman life.
Yeah, and it just brings certain efficiencies so you don't have people arguing about, you know, which
eight
way
sides.
To build
no,
things.
Six sides. No, 8 sides, motherfucker. Yeah, so anyway.
Now, even though this base at Nimeguen or Nimeguen was probably only occupied, they think, for 10 years or maybe even less, it was pretty well set up. The barracks were well built. They were neatly ordered in blocks that had a pair of rooms which would hold a tent group or a contubernium, which had 8 men in it. There was a headquarters building. There were houses built for senators or the senator who was serving as the legate. These were pretty comfortably built. And in all, they reckon these bases resembled a typical Roman city that would be springing up around this time on the fringes of the empire. They weren't slapdash affairs. They were well built, you know, constructed well, designed to last, and designed to be comfortable because if you've got men living there for 10 years, you want them to be relatively comfortable. They're living out in the fringes of the empire, away from home, away from family, away from the temples. They're, you know, surrounded by hostiles, a bit like an American base, I'm sure, in Afghanistan or Iraq today. All of the comforts of home that they can possibly get there. So the men are content to a degree anyway.
And another important aspect of this is you have to remember this is Northern Europe. So these things were built to keep these men warm during the winter. So while they're waiting for the campaign season, they're not, you know, freezing to death. They're able to stay warm because, again, Rome is bringing their superior technology to bear when it comes to building these forts. And then, like you said, they're going to be pretty comfortable for these people to wait out these ghastly European winters. Excuse me.
Well, speaking of winter, it was around the winter of 13 or 12 BCE, 13 to 12, whatever that is. What do you call that? Around the winter of 13. I'm not used to winters spanning over years. It's a confusing concept for me.
And going backwards. You're right.
The winter of 13 BCE, there was another raid by German warriors into Roman provinces. And this was all of the motivation that Drusus needed to begin his first series of attacks. So he repulsed the raid in the winter, and then in the spring, he crossed the Rhine.
Yeah, and this is a big, major operation. compared to what's come before him. Some of the Roman armies are using land routes. They're obviously following the valleys that lead into the Rhine. Others of them are boarding the ships that you talked about earlier, and they're sailing around to the North Sea to land on a coast. So not only is there a more direct invasion of crossing the Rhine, they're also going around their some of the main villages that's close to the river, landing on the North Sea coast and hitting there as well. So again, this is a very serious operation to teach these people a lesson. And even if the Germans hadn't invaded, you get the sense that, you know, Augustus wants Drusus to build up his reputation and his experience by having some warfare here. But the fact that the Germans seem to be a threat is just giving, like you said, giving them the excuse that they need. And they are launching a very serious offensive against these numerous tribes across the Rhine.
Unfortunately, when Drusus sent his ships around the North Sea to land on the coast,
he pulled a Caesar.
The intel that he had was not the best. It's a bit like when the Big JC invaded Britain and the tide had gone out further than he expected and his ships all ran aground. Same thing happened to Drusus. And fortunately for him, his ships were saved by a local tribe, the Frisii, who had decided it was better to join the Romans than fight them. So they came and saved his ships and saved his men.
Wow, yeah. But again, as they're attacking, overall, the attacks launched this particular time by Drusus were successful. They sacked a lot of the tribe's homelands. They burned villages. They vestatio'd the cows, probably. They rounded up animals, destroyed the crops. And if anybody did resist them in any kind of organized or haphazard fashion, they were defeated by the Roman troops. So again, he is getting more experience under his belt. He's learning about these different tribes, that it's not just one group of people. It's a very complex system, and he needs some intelligence on it. But again, it was a very successful campaign that he was able to launch in that winter of 1312.
Yeah, but before people start feeling too sorry for the Germans, we have to remember that there is some history between the Germanic tribes and the Romans. You know, a century or so later, Tacitus wrote that one barbarian at the time said, "Romans create a desolation and call it peace." But that's the price you pay if you resist Rome or if you try and attack Rome. Now, it's important to remember, I think, that almost a century earlier, well before Julius Caesar, back in 105 BCE, Germanic tribes led by the Cimbri and the Teutones invaded Italy. And at the Battle of Orosio, the Romans lost somewhere between 80,000 and 100,000 men.
Whoa.
And then, those tribes, the Cimbri and the Teutones, were finally defeated in 101 by Gaius Marius, Julius Caesar's uncle.
Yeah.
But the Germans were the Roman bogeymen for many decades after that, because they had nearly succeeded in invading Rome. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, the Romans hadn't been to Germany at this point. So in the minds of the Romans, I'm sure, what they're doing now is partly revenge for the invasion of 105, and it's also partly a defensive mechanism. We have to go and make sure these Germans don't try that again. Julius Caesar was the first Roman to take the battle to Germany. He crossed the Rhine once or twice briefly and then returned back to Gaul just to basically say, hey, don't fuck with me. And I know part of his justification for going to Gaul in the first place was that some Germanic tribes had come down and were interfering with some of the Roman allies in Gaul. And he said, oh, we need to go. He was going to go to Illyricum, as I recall, originally, but he changed his mind. It's a bit, in my mind, like Alexander going to Persia as revenge for the Persians' earlier invasions of Greece.
Right.
So now Augustus is going to remove the German threat once and for all.
Yeah. And like, you know, he's up there, he's around 50, 51 or whatever. And like I said earlier, these kids have got to get some experience. They've got to make a name for themselves because he is in charge of the Roman Empire and no one can do anything about that. But he has worked very hard for the people to love him. It's easier for a dictator to dictate if the people love you. And if he can get Drusus and Tiberius some claims so that they've been defending the Roman people, they are military heroes, it's going to make their job when they eventually rule that much easier. So it's pretty much a win-win-win for the Romans.
That's right. So around about the end of 12 BCE, Drusus returned to Rome for a brief visit where he was elected praetor.
Yay!
And in fact, given the post of urban praetor, responsible for looking after the infrastructure in Rome. We know that was a very prestigious post. He's only 27.
How's he supposed to carry on a war and look after Rome's infrastructure at the same time?
Delegation, Ray. Delegation.
Oh, he's pulling, just like pulling a gripper.
In all of our shows, you delegate all the work to me.
Right.
He was delegating it to other people.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
So he quickly returned to Gaul and in 11 BCE led another attack across the Rhine, this time against Julius Caesar's old foes, the Sugar Babies, no, the Sugambri and the Suebi. Now, they had done something that had upset the Romans. What had they done, Ray?
Well, they went back on their word. Some of them, after this first trouncing, made an alliance, or at least had an understanding with Rome. But maybe when some more tribes heard about this and they were willing to resist the Roman efforts, some of these people probably changed their mind and said, you know, yeah, it's a gamble, but we'll give it a chance. We've got more warriors now. They broke their word, and as you know, You can't give someone like that a second chance. You have to go and you have to go hard on them. And that's what Drusus has to do. And I think he was okay with that. I think he was good at this and I think he was in his element. And to whatever degree this is possible, he was enjoying it.
Yeah, they captured and crucified 20 centurions in their territory. Now, when you start crucifying Roman centurions.
Yeah. Big no-no.
That's when you cross the line. I mean, I think that...
Sorry. I'm not trying to be indelicate. I mean, right.
There's not too much of a bigger fuck you that you can give Romans than capturing and crucifying their centurions.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, now, we don't know exactly why they were there. They were either, you know, acting as diplomats, trying to get other tribes to come over and say, look, all we need you to do is acknowledge the greatness of Rome, pay some some taxes every once in a while or whatever, but basically just, you know, bow your head to us and we'll pretty much leave you alone. You can ask anybody. Or they were there probably, and this is probably more likely, they were recruiting more men to be auxiliaries to help fight them when the campaigning season comes. The Germans, they're smart enough to figure this out, so they're going to send a message back to Drusus and back to Rome by not just killing these guys, but going the extra mile in doing so.
And the Sugambri then attacked the chatty tribe because they just wouldn't shut up. They're just chat, so fucking chatty, these guys. They're like, oh, will you just take a fucking break of the sound of your own voice? Also because the chatty refused to join in an alliance against Rome. They're like, yeah, the Romans pretty good, you know. Medicine,
yeah.
Aqueducts, roads, wine.
Yeah.
We're a big fan of the Romans, actually. but while the Sugambri were away attacking the chatty tribe, Drusus attacked the Sugambri homeland. Ooh. While all the men were away and pretty much wiped it out, destroyed it, set fire, raped the cows, and milked the women.
So you go and you go to punish an enemy, and I couldn't find out if they were successful or not as far as against the chatty, but just imagine coming home and just the complete desolation waiting for you. I don't know, does that make you even more mad or does that take the heart out of you, which is, you know, exactly what the Romans would want it to. But I just imagine the devastation they returned to by fighting, you know, some of their own people who wouldn't join them against the Romans. That just had to be just really had to mess with them, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, that's rough, man. You come home, your women and children are dead, your village is burnt, your cows have been raped. Ray's been here. It's the first thing I'd think about. Cows are walking funny. Ray's been,
we've been visited by Ray.
Now, this gets back to something, you know, you said earlier, and I mentioned about the internecine warfare. So all of the tribes over the Rhine weren't one people. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the whole nation-state concept didn't really exist back then. Right. They were maybe even distinct peoples that had migrated to these areas from different parts up north. They were often hostile towards each other, even though the Romans thought of them as just Germans. Right. They weren't unified people. They probably didn't think of themselves as Germans. They thought of themselves as 100 different tribes. Julius Caesar, in his commentaries, thought that the Germans and the Gauls were different people, but the distinction was kind of blurry. It's really just the people who live on one side of the Rhine and the people who live on the other side of the Rhine.
Right. You people over there, Germans. You people over here, Gauls. Done. That's how you get it done.
Now, he and other authors back then depicted the Germans as being barbarians, more primitive, and at the same time more ferocious than the Gauls. Mm. I mean, they didn't have a very high opinion of the Gauls either.
But they're like, Germans.
You think the Gauls are bad? Fuck me. You should see the Germans. You think the French are smelly? Oh my God, the Germans.
Oh my God, they're
the worst.
Tree fuckers, bogs, very few roads, no big towns, no temples. Oh my God, these people are just one step up from the apes. It's really that bad.
They thought of them as uncivilized, unpredictable, and dangerous. But the interesting thing is, we now know, as a result of modern archaeology, that the Germanic tribes weren't always that way.
Right.
Before Julius Caesar even arrived in Gaul, there had been large hilltop towns in Germany that had equivalent sophistication in terms of industry and trade and organization as any of the major centers in Gaul, the Oppida, as they were known as Gaul. And you can understand that these people were at similar stages of their sort of evolution. Mm-hmm. There would have been a lot of contact between the tribes. It wasn't always war. It was a combination of trade and war. And they had lots of cultural similarities. So there had been substantial towns, but at some point, several decades before Caesar arrived in Gaul, so we're talking early first century BCE, something happened that wiped out these major towns in central Germany. They were all either abandoned or they shrunk dramatically in size. And we don't really know what happened. We know it wasn't the Romans, right, but we don't know exactly what happened.
Yeah. Do you have any guesses? The best I could possibly come up with would be some kind of plague or disease or whatever. But yeah, just for towns to be abandoned or to shrink incredibly so or whatever. Again, we don't even know if it was something like that. Was it warfare? We truly have no idea. But you would imagine that if Caesar had come along and had been as developed as Gaul was, he would probably have a different impression of it. But these people have survived something, much smaller towns. They're living a lot simpler lives than the Gauls. So it almost makes sense that he does perceive them in a lesser, less developed light.
Yeah, apparently there is evidence in the archaeological record of the bloody and violent destruction of at least one of these towns, mm-hmm, and weaponry becomes far more common in the record around this time. Mm. So there was, it may have been invaders from somewhere else. It may have been intertribal warfare. We don't really know.
Right.
But it may have even been the threat of Roman expansion. that led to this war. It may have been indirectly related to the Romans. They're like, oh, the fucking, look, if you see what's going on in Italy, man, these Romans,
right.
they are taking shit over.
Right.
They just had a war with these Carthaginians over in North Africa and shit. We need to start getting ready.
Right.
We need to get ready. You know, they already we tried to attack them. We tried to invade them. They defeated us. They're probably going to come here. We need to get ready. We need to ramp up.
Right.
And maybe there was some inter-tribal war over there. We don't know. Right. What we know is the Romans weren't responsible.
Right. So, yeah, so don't point your fingers at that thing. Yeah. So, again, it's hard for... Of course, the Romans don't know any of this. So by the time Julius Caesar comes and by the time Brutus comes, we just think this is the way it has always been. They don't know any better. But Drusus is going to work hard on gathering intelligence and trying to figure out and be able to differentiate these tribes. Because without some kind of intel on your enemy, you know, you're not going to be able to be effective against them. So he is learning as he goes. He is gathering information and trying to gather allies as he goes. Because there's no point in fighting all of Germania. You try to get as many allies as you possibly can to help you with, you know, with this very bloody business of trying to pacify these people so they'll leave Gaul and Rome alone.
So,
you haven't said anything yet to spark a song. Kind of disappointed.
I know.
We need a song. Is there a Vestadio song? Is there a slap your bitch before she leaves you song? Is there a...
I've got an idea.
Okay.
So now we don't know much about what happened to cause the collapse of these towns, but it may have been migration of new people, more aggressive people, and migrations are actually hard to trace archaeologically. Mm-hmm. People don't leave a lot of stuff behind when they're moving from one area to another because they're taking their shit with them, and all of a sudden you just see things change, but you don't really know where these, you know, what happened unless there's some extraordinary evidence of it. Yeah. There is talk, though, in the ancient sources of large groups of people moving in search of new land. I think even when we were doing Caesar's invasion of Gaul, there was some talk of the Germans moving across the Rhine down into Gaul because somebody was coming in from further north.
That's
and pushing
right.
the Germans down, right?
That was also the time of Sulla when he dressed up as a German and went into the tribes. So yeah, there was this supposedly great push from further north affecting the Germans. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I seem to recall some, you know, during these migrations I read, somebody said, how far would you walk to invade a new land? And somebody said, well, would you walk? Well, I'd walk as far as it'd take to have to find a new village. They said, would you walk, you know, 10 miles? Yeah, I'd walk 10 miles. Would you walk 100 miles? Yeah, I'd walk. Would you walk 200 miles? I would. In fact, I would.
When I wake up, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who wakes up next to you. When I go out, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who goes along with you. If I get drunk, well, I know I'm gonna be the man who gets drunk next to you. And if I haver, yeah, I know I'm gonna be the man who's havering to you. But I would walk 500 miles and I would walk 500 more just to be the man who walked 1,000 miles to fall down at your door.
When I'm working, yes, I know I'm gonna be the man who's working hard for you. The money comes in for the work I do. I'll pass almost every penny on to you. When I come home,
when I come home,
oh, I know I'm gonna be the man who comes back home to you. And if I broke, well, I know I'm gonna be
anyway. That's the best I can come up with on short notice.
Isn't there some kind of software that can wipe out those accents while they're singing? That's really annoying.
I was thinking migration songs. What songs do I know about migration?
Oh, God, I don't.
You know, it's not a topic that gets sung about enough in rock music.
By pop artists. There's Walk Like an Egyptian, yeah. But that's not quite the same thing.
Stop dragging my heart around.
Migration.
No, that's good. No, nothing to do. I think I fucking nailed it. The point of all this being, the large towns were gone. Yeah. But there was still a large population and small farms and villages which remained for several generations. There was still plenty of farming, even though the Romans didn't really think of the Germans as an agricultural people. But most of the farming that they had was mainly geared to just feeding the local population and probably didn't generate a surplus for trade,
right,
or to cushion them against bad harvests. They weren't that sophisticated at this point in time. And there is evidence of large populations periodically being on the move. And the best the Romans could do when they rocked up was just to try and figure out who are the tribes that we have today, right, where are their current homelands, who are their current leaders. They didn't have time to sort of do the historical record of these people and figure out, you know, where they came from originally and what their trading relationship or political relationship. They would, we just call them fucking Germans. Right. That'll do.
You're all German. Congratulations.
You're all Germans, yeah. But we're not Germans. Yes, you are. Shut up. You're all Germans.
That's right. Look, I wrote it down here in my ledger. German, right there. Now, the downside of this, whatever you want to call it, whatever happened to this vital, vibrant society that it was east of the Rhine, and now that it's been reduced to whatever, things are going to, you know, you have to take that into consideration when you're attacking the area. Obviously, you have to have supplies, you have to have food, you have to have fodder for your horses. If there's big, large towns with a bunch of stored grain or whatever, you could just go in there, kill everybody and take the food and keep on going. But that's not the case on the eastern side of the Rhine. So there's a lot of little places that it's just too spread out. So Drusus is going to figure this out very carefully. He's going to have to bring his own food, his own fodder for his horses, which means a massive baggage train, which means that he's going to have to go very slow. He can't just go anywhere he wants. He's going to have to take paths that are going to be possible for his baggage trains. And this is going to affect him tactically and strategically. And the Germans are going to figure this out as well. So in some ways, he's got one hand tied behind his back, but he still has a very impressive professional Roman army. But this is something that is going to affect him as he attacks in the future.
Yeah, it was very difficult for Drusus to move troops and men through. This is one of the reasons why he probably sent a bunch of them on ships up the North Sea to try and move through this territory where there aren't good roads. It's just a lot of forests and bogs and that kind of stuff. It's very slow going. Right. Particularly when you have to bring your supply train with you. When Caesar went into Gaul, they had large towns. He could just say, hey, give me all your food. And they're like, we don't want to give you all your food. Shut up. Give me all your food. But because there were big towns in Gaul, right, but there were no big towns in Germany at this juncture. So it's a lot harder to go to hundreds of small villages to get enough food and fodder to supply your army and your animals and that kind of stuff. At this point in time, he's got about 8 legions, roughly 45,000 troops, plus thousands of auxiliaries on top of that, plus horses, damn, and all this kind of shit. So that's a lot of food and fodder, and it's hard to take with you, again, through forests and bogs and marshes, no roads, all that kind of shit, very slow going. So he would have used barges to take some of it down rivers and then would follow the rivers as best as he could, and then probably moved some of it with his army on the ships around to the North Sea.
Yeah.
Now, I know we're probably...
How are we going for time?
We should stop, but we should end with this. The second season of fighting, you might as well call it Drusus Longer, Meaner, Deeper, because he is going to go even further into German held territory. He's been doing pretty well as far as the tribes that are near the Rhine River. He's going to go even further. And I did put a very well done map. I didn't do it. A well done map on Facebook on the Life of Caesar page, just to show you what he and his brother were able to accomplish. They are going very, very far into German territory, which is even more dangerous, but he is learning things and he is getting better at being a general.
Well, let's wrap it up there. I do want to do a couple of reviews because I didn't do one last episode. Here's a review from Australia. Oh. NJC 1000 writes, a constant companion. I've been listening to Ray and Cam for a couple of years now, and their humour and love of history have greatly helped the grim daily commute to the coal mine slash office. The humour is, shall we say, not for the easily offended, but at least they know where to draw the line. Oh, I've done this one before. This is the goat one. Fuck that. Stop that. Edit. Beep. Okay. This is a review from Average Paddington. Have I done Average Paddington before? That sounds familiar. United States. You'll laugh so hard you'll forget you're learning. Cam and Ray wind their way through this hilarious take on the life of Caesar. Cam's detailed notes and penchant for 80s music. I'm sure I've done this before. Yeah, I've done this before.
Okay.
Have I done this before? Make you laugh.
Well, a lot of people mention 80s music, so don't be confused by that. To me, it doesn't sound like you've done it before. But you know what I'm saying though?
Let me just search.
A lot of the reviews have mentioned the same things.
Okay, I can't find a reference to this, so I'll do it again. Average Paddington from the United States writes, you'll laugh so hard you'll forget you're learning. Cam and Ray wind their way through this hilarious take on the life of Caesar. Cam's detailed notes and penchant for 80s music help him connect Caesar to both the ancient and modern worlds. Ray Harris of the excellent World War II podcast contributes masterfully timed giggles and backup vocals to keep the laughs and jams going.
It is a skill.
The narrative often gives way to tangents of every variety, but Cam and Ray's takes on whatever tangential issue they tackle make you sometimes wish that the narrative would stop completely and they'd do whole podcasts on the importance of infrastructure or whatever else they touch. You'll laugh and learn from the intro to the outro, so stop what you're doing and listen to this podcast.
Damn right.
Thank you, Average Paddington. I'll also read this one from Jeff MB77 from the United Kingdom. He writes, pair of chicken chokers do history. Been with these guys since the beginning. I have laughed, cringed, and everything in between. Subway. Sure, I can do dry history, but I find it much more appealing when delivered in Ray and Cam's uniquely unpretentious way. If you're at all offended by bad language, crude jokes, and boyish humor, then go do one and stop being so uptight.
Hear, hear.
I, for one, appreciate this witty and well-informed podcast as much as I still find a good ripper funny, which is a lot. Big five stars, Jeff London. Thank you, Jeff. I'm not sure that Jeff London or Jeff from London. Either way, Jeff and Paddington, send us an email with your postal addresses and we will send you a token of our appreciation. That's the show. We will be back next week with the rest of Drusus's life in one episode.
Come on, everybody. We are in the moment of passion, our throes of passion, the beast with two backs, if you will.
Dio disagrees with this.
Shut the fuck up. Move on.
Okay. Sorry.
Better not be Toto.
What?
Fuck that. I'm Augustus.
Get your fucking... Yeah, look, I don't even watch Star Trek, and I know that the chronology
is... It was still Trek land, but at the end of the day, you have to get past that cynicism.
So, shut the fuck up. What do you want?
I'm emotionally spent. I'm done for the night.